kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, welcome to episode 67 of Today in Digital Education with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Doug Barnes. Good evening, Doug. How are you doing?
I'm good. We're going to be talking about working open today, which is very appropriate given that we've spent the weekend at the Mozilla Festival.
Yes, it was very nice to meet up on Saturday, have a cup of coffee. Thank you very much for my tea, I think I had, and cookie.
It was good. Yeah,
it's good to catch up.
It was indeed.
So your experience in MozFest, did you get to do anything other than what you were there to do with We Are Open?
So I did go to a couple of other things and I wandered around, but I didn't really go to any sessions on other floors. I think you did, though.
I mean, I went to some, yeah. So I was a bit sort of overwhelmed by it, really, and sort of wandered around to get my bearings.
Your first time there.
It is my first time, yes. And I think it's the 6th MozFest or something like that. Was it about that? Something like that. So I wandered around and basically my day consisted of 3 sessions other than the sort of peripheral things that I did, like attending little art things and checking different things out and whatever. And the session, I came to the first We Are Open session with which Brian ran on Thinking Sideways, which I thought was excellent. So I really enjoyed it.
Just before you go on, I often try to put into words what MozFest is like for people who go to maybe a standard conference or event or even an unconference. What was your kind of first impression of maybe, first of all, the building, what was going on, the feeling you got from going there? Because to me, it's as much an experience like that as it is the sessions themselves, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's... So first of all, you sort of rocked up and you're first struck by there's lots of different kinds of people there. You know, people... I mean, no one's in a suit as such, but there are people who are clearly professional and that's their normal MO. To people who are nothing like that at all, with lots of coloured hair around and looking a bit wacky, to young people, to parents with their children, sort of families there, and all that sort of thing. The building is kind of zany on one side of the O2 arena, and you sort of go in, and it's just really nice. It's really welcoming. It's sort of a good vibe about it. Everything's quite busy. It's spread over 9 floors, which are kind of staggered into each other. So there's a lot of stair
climbs. Kind of hand-scrawled things of... come to my session, it's at this time, and then some of them haven't been ripped down from the previous day, and there's things being thrown over the side of the very open plan space saying Moz science and journalism.
Yeah, that's it. There were some really cool little things, like something that I really liked actually was on the stairs. There were often, so on the, what do you call them, the sort of drops of the stairs, there were like stickers telling you where you were going and sort of orienting you, and that was really good. And lots of, as you say, these sort of handmade posters that have been made to sort of advertise people's different events and sessions that they were running to encourage you to go to them. And it was all sort of a bit crazy and chaotic, and there were lots of things to catch your eye all day long, you know. It was really, really good. So it felt really kind of funky, but overall I'd say the biggest thing for me was that stuff happened that I really didn't expect to happen. So coming to see you guys is what I did expect to happen, kind of thing, because I knew you were there and that was all good. And I enjoyed Brian's session very much, looking at thinking through pictures and that kind of thing, through drawing sort of thing, and the constraints that that puts on it and how it condenses your thinking and sharpens your mind or forces your mind to sharpen up a bit. Then I went to a session. There was this woman there who went to Kenya with her husband, and she decided to move there after a week of being there, which is a bit bonkers.
Wow.
But it is a really beautiful place and lovely place as well, the sort of people and things. So she's gone out there. She's a software engineer, and so they moved lock, stock and barrel with their son out there. And she's looking at ways of doing stuff in the Maasai Mara to empower local people through entrepreneurship. So local people in Kenya are sort of priced out of being entrepreneurs because they haven't got any startup costs and things like that. Mm-hmm. So the example that she used, that she's actually practically doing, is she's found this gentleman called Jacob, who's a safari guide, but he has to work for the big safari camps, which are often owned by Mzungus, which are it's sort of white money. White people and their money coming into Kenya. And because he can't afford a Jeep, and B, he can't advertise his services to the Western world where the money is, kind of thing, then he has to work for $5 a day when people are paying $500 a day for his services. So she's sort of trying to sort him out as an independent there and got me set up with a website and the ability to get in touch and book his services. But she's also got some other interesting things going on. So she's living and working in the Mara, which is where I'm doing my project that I've discussed on here before of setting up a mobile computing classroom. So there are overlaps in there. And obviously the guy who's an old boy of my school, Dominic Grammaticus, owns the governor's camps. And there are seven of those. And they're the largest safari organization in the Mara. So she is one of the sort of people. It was an interesting juxtaposition of you know, this small and entrepreneurial business and this massive one.
I'm reading through your blog post. You've written about these three things. Had you like picked out the session, or did you stumble upon it?
Oh no. So first of all, when I rocked up in the morning, I was walking around with a cup of coffee. There was another Kenyan project going on, coincidentally, and I tried to talk to some people there, but they didn't seem to be very forthcoming. So I didn't really talk to them. Then I didn't even know the session was on, and I was just going through the very good little Mozilla app that Mozilla had made to allow you to go and like heart your sessions that you wanted to go to, so you could aggregate your day and sort of work out what was most important to you. And so I just kind of stumbled across it, and I thought, well, I'm going to go to that. And one thing the app didn't do, it didn't tell you very much about what the sessions were about. It just kind of gave you the headlines and the people and the venue, the time. So I thought, well, I'm going to go there because that's going to have some interest to me somehow, I think. So I went there, and I was there for an hour and a half, and just ended up chatting. And there were lots of other people, well, no, about half a dozen other people there. And she didn't really know what she wanted to do. She was there with another scientist. She's a scientist by training as well. And they're looking at you how to aggregate data within the Mara. There aren't very many scientists actually live and work in the Mara or work in the Mara at all. So trying to do that and looking at the bioactive plants and their relationship to the different animals on the Mara, because the bioactive plants are ones that the Maasai have used for years and years and years, obviously, as their medicine, and that we use in our medicines and things like that. And they're the important plants of the world, one might argue. And they're often, because they have organic matter in them, these bioactive ingredients, they're associated with different animals. So it's about tracing the path of the animals and the plants and what lives together, if you see what I mean. So they're looking at ways of doing that. And then she had these really interesting things of cultural tourism. So she said that a lot of Maasai don't take electricity into their properties because when tourists come over, they want to see native Maasai as they've always been.
Oh, so they're basically frozen in time, because if they move forward, then they'll lose their income for being like old-fashioned and
exactly authentic. Their tourist income, which is obviously a big deal. So she's saying it's the thing. So she had these different ideas. For example, the jewelry that gets made over there is that you would go and make jewelry with them. You'd go and make tire sandals, which are a version of the sort of...
Oh, this is when you were talking. We mentioned this briefly. You said that she wanted to set up a museum so that they didn't have to basically turn their house into museums.
Yeah, so like one of those sort of interactive people museums so that, yeah, they didn't have to turn their houses into...
I mean, I've seen this done quite well in Dubai, actually. So Dubai's got some great museums, and it shows... you know, the rapid expansion from the 1950s, 60s, nobody wants to live in a hut, obviously, in Dubai. Like, you want to live in a massive tower block and reap all of the oil money. And so they've got some fantastic museums right in the heart of the city, run by the creek and stuff. And I think if they followed that kind of model, that could work really well. I mean, obviously, it's a lot easier in Dubai because they've got huge amounts of oil money, but even so.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? And I think it has a lot of value. So all these different, she listed about a dozen different activities that she thinks tourists would be interested in doing, gastronomy trails and treks and things like that, where you can actually eat the plants that are around in the Mara and things like that. I thought that would be, you get a sort of, I guess, an authentic Maasai experience without the actual Maasai themselves having to not be able to go home and watch the telly that situation, you know what I mean? Where they have more modern homes and things.
So presumably you didn't go along to MozFest thinking, hey, I'm going to sync up my project from school with...
No, I didn't at all. I mean, I think the plan is that we go out again in Easter and in 2017, and she's dead up for like meeting up with the pupils from the school and talking about that, and I'll be able to put her in contact with people at the Mara. She wants to run local sort of brainstorming workshoppy things to explore how the best way for her to achieve the different goals that she's identified, to do that and to get people involved, kind of thing. So I can hook her up with lots of local people because I work with them when I go out there, not because
it's balance, isn't it? I mean, from what you've described and having not gone to the session, first thought is, oh, programmers and engineering mindsets and Silicon Valley narrative and trying to fix the world through tech and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, there's obviously identifiable problems that need to be solved. And
yeah, no, it's exactly right. And it's also about you know, progress, I believe, in societies is made within a community, and when you pull as many people as possible into that community, as it were, and get them involved, or pull different parts of the community together, I think you're going to come up with the best work. So that was that. So that's really positive, and I'm really looking forward to working with Steph a bit more in the future. Anyway, so then the last session I went to, I thought about coming to, you had another session in the afternoon, I thought about coming to that, and then I thought, I'm going to go to a portfolio session. So there was a company called Dreamyard, which was a school out in the Bronx in New York.
It's kind of a hackerspace, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very much like that. So all these sessions were very cobbled together. There's, you know, there's partitions put up in big, big rooms, and you have your space, and it's about the team that you're working with and sort of taking ownership over the space. It's about
terms of Dreamyard is as well.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
Yeah. The reason I know about Dreamyard is that one of my clients, one of the co-op's clients, is London Connected Learning Centre, who I've mentioned many times before, including Sarah Horrocks. Hi, Sarah, if you're listening. And Sarah had said and introduced me by email to Hilary Kolos, who I think was running that session.
Mm-hmm. And, yes, that's correct.
And Dreamyard's work has very much inspired London CLC's work in terms of their strapline, tagline, and approach to things, etc. So I only managed to meet Hilary very briefly, and I think that session that you went to was not at the same time as one we were running. I think that's what you just said. But mm-hmm. Yeah, just go into what they did, because it was a shame that I missed that.
Well, it was, first of all, it was a bit bizarre because there were, I don't know, sort of 14 people in the session maybe, and about 10 of them were from Chicago, a different sort of place than Chicago. And I just thought, this is all a bit strange, you know. I know Chicago and New York aren't particularly close, but still they're here in London and they're all kind of meeting up. But maybe they're the opportunities that present themselves, I don't know. But they were looking at, they've been using portfolios in their school, which is a very different school to mine, I guess. I come back to the idea that I want my pupils to push over the wall of sharing, and publishing to the real world and online and that kind of thing, and using social media in a more sort of proactive way. The idea of publishing your learning to a young person is pretty scary in this world of social media. I think, and it's just, they just don't see the relevance of it, and it's really difficult. I find it really difficult to persuade them of that, and which is odd for me because I can persuade most people about most things generally. And so,
especially when you get all the tools out.
Well, yeah. So it was a bit weird. I find that all a bit weird, and how I'm going to achieve that, I think. And
so there's an image on your blog, which I'm presuming you made, because it's got a barefoot mark on.
Yes.
It says, my one URL 5-minute sketch. What's that about?
So the principle is that they want, so I think it's on, it might be to apply for a job in Mozilla, actually. The application was just a one URL, and they use this as a source of it. So if you have one URL, you know, you're applying for something, you have one URL to put in your application, what are you going to include on URL? And you had to kind of design that and bring it all in. This is something we're not particularly unfamiliar with. I have a landing page, you have a landing page on the web, and that's kind of what you do. But if you, this is about the interesting points were how the children would learn to curate the content that they have been making. So you have this sort of tension between product and process. You know, if you're publishing a portfolio, do you publish final shiny products, or do you publish the process of working and learning? Do you publish the development? We all know that development is
so much
more.
So what did you choose? I can see some of the things on here. You've got music, a big thing that's saying inside, presumably
so this was just a thing, like a 5-minute activity, and they threw loads of bits of papers and scissors and glue, so I just felt them in magazines, so I just ripped some crap out of a magazine and stuck it on a piece of paper that I thought was a nice color at the time, and then just drew some stuff around it. Really, I didn't think it was a big deal or particular. I mean, it was nice to do something, and it was a bit of an icebreaker really, more than that, rather than anything else, I think. But I was trying to think about what it is that I would want to do. So I've published a bit of music and the stuff that I've written, and I'd sort of like to put that on there and have that as part of my identity and whatever it was, no matter where I was applying for. But then I'd want sort of some way of showing the reader that I have insight into the world, that I'm looking at the world and that kind of thing, and making connections in the world. And then also I'd want my work in snapshots, but I don't really think about what that might look like, which really is the important thing.
You tell what this reminds me of?
Mm-hmm.
MySpace. So
yeah,
MySpace was awful in terms of when you went there, there were things flashing, there were things, the color schemes which didn't go together and stuff. But the wonderful thing was it was an expression of personality no matter how old you were. And you really got a sense of who this person was. And you get some sense that even though it was a very short activity and you've ripped random crap out of magazines and stuff.
Yeah.
And I can imagine you taking this in the earlier days of teaching HTML and stuff and turning it into some kind of image map and cutting out bits and making some of it hyperlinked and that kind of thing. Whereas mm-hmm. now, a lot of people publish on things like WordPress.com and Medium and other places where there's almost like a default style that it's either very difficult to change or you can't change, and everything's just a bit the same, like on social networks and stuff. Like, it looks great, but everyone's got a very similar style. And so I'd love to see a return to this kind of thing, and then you make it very, very unique.
Well, it's quite interesting. So the tools that they've used and found really successful, they use Tumblr, but they can't use that in schools usually because it's blocked because of inappropriate content, I guess. So they've used Wix quite a lot, which is a sort of website making space. Someone pointed out something in Slack the other day called Webflow. Looks really interesting as a way, but there's other ones like Squarespace.
I wasn't sure, but I think Fuzzy Fox, who used to be on my team at Mozilla, he has been contributing to Mozilla since he was tiny. He's now finished uni, and he was working for them, so for the BBC. I think he's working for that, because when I caught up with him quickly, he said that he's working for a company, and he's got equity as well, for a company that allows you to make websites without doing any design or coding.
Well, Webflow really looks like that. It looks really interesting. I've just had a quick look at it, but I thought I'd introduce it to some pupils and see if what they could do with it in anger, you know.
Could you stick the URL into the show notes?
I will do, yes. So they were using that, but one of the things that they found most successful, actually, as in reducing barriers to entry of making a portfolio, is just using Google Slides and setting them to public. Because the pupils feel fully in command of a Google Slide, and it's not like putting it out in as a website. Do you know what I mean? I guess it doesn't feel. I guess it feels like you're kind of renting, not making a home or something. I don't know. And so they found that Google Slides have been really, really useful for that. So that's that. We talked about different ways.
There's just something that's reminded me of an app called Monogram by Moo.com, which I think we've mentioned before because my son was messing about with it sometime. But I'll stick that in there because this is an iOS app which works in kind of a business cardy way, but it's an app and it allows you to create like a portfolio on the fly. It might be useful for people who haven't heard of it before.
It might indeed. Okay, I'm just putting Webflow into the notes. So the session was sort of good, and it was it's sort of useful. It was a little bit tokenistic in the sorts of ways, you know. It was kind of pushing through and not really exploring things in too much detail. But it was interesting to see the work that they're doing and to see their experience of it. But really what it comes down to, I think, so the guy called Rudy, someone said that they actually had lessons dedicated to portfolio creation. So they would in the first year of the school, they would get the children to literally learn how to create digital artifacts out of their work, how to curate them, and how to publish them online.
Well, what you're doing there is it's digital identity, isn't it? That's what you're doing. You're showing how to have agency in a new digital space.
I thought it was interesting, yeah. And so, so sort of on reflection, what I felt about that is that it became an issue of, like, you know how ICT lessons were in our country, which is information communication technology, for those who are not familiar with it, and not computing, not coding, not programming. But they would involve the web, and they would involve a lot of office work as well, Microsoft Office. So you were kind of moving that to now, to actually focusing more on using the tools that are available on the web, and how to make your own content. You know, the web is a place of user-generated content now, and it was looking at how to actually make that content. So it was a good session.
In all the sessions you went to, did you or anyone else kind of vote with their feet and drift in or drift out of sessions?
People were able. I mean, the thing that I found about it that was sort of a bit odd about MozFest in total, actually, is that the sessions were staggered, so they weren't all the same length. So I went to 3 long sessions in the day and then did some little bits in between. That didn't necessarily, I mean, it was kind of good and kind of just meant that you couldn't go to other things. But I think people left sessions halfway through to go and attend another session. So people obviously would pick their favorites and then picked a little bit of something else they'd go and see or whatever.
I think some people leave sessions just because it's not what they were expecting or they've got everything. You know, we've talked about this with MOOCs, like you get what you want and then you head off. And that's just part of, you know, in the facilitator's briefing on the Friday, as has been told in every facilitator's briefing ever at MozFest, you're told this is a good thing. It means that people can see what they want, they can get what they want out of it, there's no shame, people drift in and out. And certainly in our sessions, people came in halfway through, people left halfway through, people realized after 5 minutes and just went, you know, sorry, this is not what I was expecting, and go, and it's all good.
Yeah, I think so. And it's about having the robustness in what you're, a belief in what you're doing to not get worried by that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Certainly there were a couple in yours came late, like halfway through, and then others left before the end.
Yeah.
Everyone stayed around for quite a long while, though, I think. And in the Maasai session as well, people were off to do different things because the session was actually scheduled for 2 hours, which it really didn't need. But I guess that's because they'd come from Kenya to do this in part, at least. And then they wanted to make the most of it and all of that and make sure they had enough time to do it.
It's worth saying that Mozilla pay a stipend to quite a lot of people who are coming internationally to make sure that they can get there.
So people get paid to come.
You know, the example of Chicago and New York, you know, mm-hmm. Chicago to New York is, well, I don't know the exact, it's probably the length of England, though, isn't it?
And yeah.
So there's no reason why people in Chicago and New York would necessarily have the money or the time to be able to go and share work with one another. Therefore, they're in a space which celebrates openness and diversity, etc. So, like, why wouldn't they go to each other's sessions?
No, absolutely. And and quite clearly, some of them knew each other as well. And so they're obviously working within the education circuit, digital education circuit over there.
Yep.
And that makes a lot of sense. I was a little bit concerned, to be honest, that they'd come over on public money kind of thing. Because clearly working for museums and or different things like that. You don't, never, you know, schools don't seem to be schools anymore sometimes, and museums don't seem to be museums. Mm. But that's what they seem to call themselves. And that was all fine. Everyone was, you know, dead cheerful and on board and trying to achieve what they needed to achieve. It was good. Cool.
Yeah, so I mean, if Brian Mathers is listening, thank you again, Brian, for allowing me to stay at your house. So I stayed there Friday night and Saturday night. And I'll say once again, they have such a wonderful, creative, welcoming household that it was a joy and a pleasure to be there. And it also meant that I didn't have to get involved with the Saturday night craziness. I think there were some kind of monks walking around, including Brother JavaScript, and there was some kind of immersive theatre going on. Which sounded and looked pretty tame, but I know what Mozilla stuff ends up like, and I've been there in the early hours of the morning with the karaoke, so I'm pleased, you know, as I'm getting old, I didn't have to get involved in any of that, so that was good. Anyway, enough about MozFest, I think. What have you been up to this week apart from MozFest?
Well, one of the things I did, since you just mentioned Brian, I'll just put a tweet into the show notes. Is that I invested in his Indiegogo visual thinkery this week.
Oh, good.
And he, I invested a very modest amount, but he drew me a picture as a thank you.
I did see that actually. Yeah, that's great.
I just didn't see it.
It's so, Monty Python-esque, isn't it?
It is indeed. So I'll just put that in here. So it's a picture of my foot, which
I saw because you've put an Instagram video, haven't you, in your blog post,
yes,
about you walking barefoot through the tube on the Northern Line.
Yeah, so I was barefoot for the day in London, which is, it sounds like crazy, but it's really not a big deal. and kind of thing. But Brian very nicely drew a picture of my foot anyway and sent me on Twitter, which was very good of you. So thank you very much, Brian. I was very touched.
Lovely. I'll talk later, but we're doing some work together on Friday, which I'm looking forward to. I've just stuck in the show notes there what the We Are Open Co-op got up to at MozFest, just very briefly, the three sessions, etc. Just making sure we had something out there. But those three sessions were all badge-related, went pretty well. Unsurprisingly, Brian's session was more well-attended than the others because, you know, it was much more creative and mine was discussion-based, but still some really, really good connections. And given that the announcement, which we haven't mentioned, about open badges, which on Friday, I'd known about this for a couple of weeks and had to kind of bite my tongue, but basically what's happened is that if you go to the new openbadges.org website, it still says Mozilla LRNG, which is the kind of spin-off thing from MacArthur, but also IMS. Now, they've all been on the board of the Badge Alliance, but the announcement is basically the Badge Alliance won't exist from the 1st of January 2017, and that IMS Global Consortium, which is a non-profit looking after education technology standards, much bigger in the US than here, as many things are, they are taking over the development of open badges from that point forward. And the executive director of the Badge Alliance, who is Nate Otto, who was there at MozFest, he will be doing some work with IMS. And the only thing that concerns me, I think in the whole, this is a fantastic move, because what it means is that open badges are now, and who was it who was saying this a lot? John Bevan was saying this a lot. Like, open badges are now boring. This is a good thing. Open badges now aren't, oh, Doug, come to my conference and tell me about open badges. And, oh, it's not like, what can open badges do for higher education? It's now, these exist, they're now boring. What interesting stuff can we do with this now reasonably boring technology? So IMS are looking after that. And my concern is that the community element of open badges, which has meant that it's kept going and the ups and downs, etc., that remains strong and that there's a place for that. So I'm looking forward to helping in whatever way I can to make sure that remains a thing.
Cool.
So it was good to talk to various people about that. It was good to see my old Mozilla colleagues, some of whom have also left Mozilla, a lot of them who are still with Mozilla, good to catch up with them. The other thing that's happened to me this week is that I've started writing for a couple of publications. I've kind of teased this, I guess, in the last couple of weeks because the posts that I've been referencing haven't been published. We're going to be talking about one in the main bit, but one which I'll just mention, which was published today, yesterday, we're recording this on a Tuesday. It's a bizarrely titled blog post on a new blog called New Co-Shift, Getting Shift Done.
Hang on, I'm going to stop you. I'm just on IMS's website, right? And in the news section at the bottom, the second article in the news section is A New Dawn for Open Badges. Does that ring a bell?
It's my blog post, I know. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, they put your blog post down. That's really awesome. Mm. I went on it and I thought, that's the same theme Doug's got. No. It's your blog.
No, well, I mentioned this to the IMS guy who was there at MozFest and they went, oh, they must have liked your blog post.
All right.
This is the value of CC0 licenses. You can just do whatever you want with other people's stuff.
Yes. True. Sorry, back to NewCo.
So NewCo Shift. A guy called John Battelle, he is an ex-editor of Wired in the US, and he started off NewCo Shift, which is all about the greatest shift that's happened in the economy since the Industrial Revolution. And that was earlier this year. And they've got some funding for a few months as an experiment. I think it's Xero, who are like an accountancy app, and Work Market, which is a way to look after freelancers. And they are doing this thing called Getting Shift Done, which is obviously a bit of a play on words. And the idea is to take SaaS apps, so software as a service apps, and do tips and tricks around that. So imagine that someone's never used this app before. How would they use it in this specific way that you're recommending to get shift done? So the first one that I've written, and I've pitched these to an editor, and they've kind of selected ones that they think would work, is a bizarrely titled one, How to Productively Stalk Your Coworkers Using Dropbox Paper. And I mentioned this is the first one that's gone on there on the very first day of this new blog with my name at the top. And the image that they've used to illustrate it is fine, but does look slightly creepy. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. So it's a gentleman standing horizontally on a wall, overlooking a woman's desk. She's working at her computer and looking sort of shiftily over her shoulder, and he's staring with a pair of binoculars straight down at her computer. But it also looks like he's staring down her top.
It does look like that. But, you know, hey, shape. Next time I'll make sure that I pitch the photograph as well.
I think
the not just the screenshots. So, you know, I talk about basically, you know, like Dropbox paper. You can see who's... if Dropbox paper works a lot like Google Docs. You can see who's viewed it. You can see who's commented, etc. Which means that instead of sharing a document by email and never knowing whether people have even looked at it, etc., you can productively stalk your colleagues. So I've got other ones which are coming out around Trello and Evernote and Google Flights and all sorts of stuff. And so the idea is that I'm going to write about 5 blog posts a week for them, which will, you know, be a useful thing to do. And it's a different style of writing for me. So I'm pretty excited about that. Should be good.
Oh, that's good. It's nice. I've not used Dropbox in that way. I've stopped using Dropbox, really. I still have it installed, but I don't actually use it.
Hmm. Well, this is Dropbox paper, which I think is a pretty new thing and results from, I think it was almost 2.5-3 years ago now, they bought Hackpad, which still exists and I think is an open source application, but they've now integrated with Dropbox and Dropbox paper.
Okay, cool. That's good.
Another thing I wanted to mention actually before we get into the meat of it, and sorry we're taking a while in the introduction, but that's because of MozFest, was a game, and we don't often mention games on here, but this particular game really kind of grabbed me yesterday after I installed it, and it's called Pinout. So you've seen Tron Legacy, yeah?
I have, yes.
So Tron Legacy is such an awesome film. It's only got like 6.8 on IMDb, but for me, it's in my top 10 favorite films. Partly because it's all futuristic, partly because it's got a soundtrack by Daft Punk. You know, some of my favorite music ever. But just, I love the whole aesthetic of it. And so this Pinout app, it's basically like a pinball table. But the pinball table, like, the aim is to get to the top of it and then keep on going so it never finishes. And you have to kind of play to see, but it's got that kind of Tron Legacy light bike aesthetic. And the music is very Daft Punky. And I really like the business model, because the business model is you get it for free, and then you can play it. And then if you want to save your progress so that you can come back to it later and close the app and go into something else, you have to pay like £1.49 for that privilege, which I will definitely be doing.
So I think I love that business model. And the reason I like it is because it's where, so with a lot of technology, a lot of stuff gets bought without there being a real good purpose to that stuff. But eventually that stops happening. Because it's not so new and not so shiny, and people learn essentially about what it is that they want, etc. So the reason I like this business model is because it says if you want to play our game and you enjoy our game and you want to play it so you can keep advancing through the game, it's not like buy levels or anything like that. It's kind of buy your checkpoint, which means that you only buy it, you get to try it in all of its glory, and you can carry on playing it from the beginning each time, or you can save your progress, and it's worth spending the money on.
Yeah,
and that's just a mature way.
There's no point in paying for it until you're good enough to get to the higher levels, because you can just play through the earlier ones. The other thing I did this week, I bought the most expensive iOS app I've bought for a while, and then got it refunded about 12 hours later.
Which was that?
Yeah, so can you remember that there was an app called, or a program back, I must have used about 10, 15 years ago, called Reason? Music app.
No.
Reason and Rebirth. So this was taking like the 808 and the 303 and all the kind of stuff that, you know, Daft Punk started on their first album, Chemical Brothers, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Very 80s style synthesizers. So they used to be hardware synthesizers, and then they were made into software tools. And I used to mess about with this for ages when I was younger, with MIDI cables and keyboards and stuff. And I used to love it. And I bought the iOS app expecting great things. And the problem was that it was okay, but like it looked really pixelated on a Retina screen on the iPad. And it just wasn't as much fun, because GarageBand is so much more advanced. So I'd forgotten the fact that you can actually get apps refunded on... They don't make it easy, but if you go into iTunes and go through your purchases, they make it pretty easy when you know what you're looking for. If you just Google getting apps refunded on iOS. And so, yeah. I paid $10.99 there, got refunded.
Wow, $10.99, that's huge. Cool. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right, let's open the working open section, shall we?
Let's do that.
So, what we're going to look at, so we discussed what it is to work open in the first of the season, post-summer podcast. We talked about it then, didn't we?
Yeah, episode 61, wasn't it?
That's right. And so now we're going to look at what it is to be working open. And discuss that a little bit more. And I think it's a big deal. So
actually, before we start, that's just reminded me of a blog post that Matt, who I used to work with at Matt Thompson, who I used to work with at Mozilla, wrote today. So Matt Thompson works for Mozilla. He's a senior director at Mozilla. And he today managed to, or was it yesterday? No, it was over the weekend, that's right. He managed to do this epic fail. So there's like 3 million people, something like that, follow the Mozilla Twitter account, and he's got the keys to the kingdom. He can get into that. And he was in a rush, getting ready for a session at MozFest, and he tweeted out a link to an Etherpad, which they were using for that session. And instead of using his personal account, he managed to tweet it from the Mozilla account. And his blog post just basically goes through his learning from that and the serendipitous things that happened as a result. So let me just find the link to that. Because what he found was that people showed up in the app. I mean, when you're tweeting it out to 3 million people, that's going to happen. And people started appearing in the pad, not knowing what was going on. Some trolls got in there at first and started, like, dissing him and things. But then the people who were left after a while just started collaborating with each other. And when he said that the pad was now going to be deleted, they were a bit upset.
Really?
So let me stick this in the pad. And so this is one of the things about working open. Like, you don't know who's going to get in there. It might be trolls, it might be people who you're never going to meet again. It might be, you know, your best friend. I'll just stick that in there. So, yeah, Mozilla work open by default, and to such an extent that when Mozilla now use Google Apps for collaborating with and all that kind of stuff and email, and there was some pushback on that, etc., and there was a lot of negotiation. And one of the things that they wanted to be able to do was to have, for example, Google Docs be published openly and publicly by default, and they had to work with Google to make sure that could happen, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a bold move. Like, it's a deep-rooted philosophy in Mozilla. He's reading the post. Anyway, so while you're reading that, and it's a perfect example of the good and the bad of working open. I've written a couple of things which both got published at the start of this, or in the last few days. One in DML Central, which I publish to every month and have done for a few years, and that's always EdTech related in some way. And a new one called The Nastarian. So The Nastarian is the blog of Nastar, and Nastar are one of the UK's largest managed IT service providers, and they made a big acquisition earlier this year, so they're moving into cloud computing, and they wanted, I guess, kind of content marketing, which is when you provide stuff which is useful to an audience, and you're doing it on your blog, which is pointing to your product as well, that kind of thing. So they're paying me to write monthly for them, and they've given me a pretty open brief about what is to write about. So what I did was I took the opportunity to write about the importance of working open in education for DML Central, and then kind of the unexpected benefits of working open in business for the Nastarian. So I thought it might be worth just talking about, you know, some of the things in there briefly.
Yeah, so I've read the Nastarian article, which I thought was really, really good. It make a really good case for working openly and the benefits that it might bring to your business, to your organization, and to the work that you're trying to achieve. And when I thought about it, I guess, so I'm trying to, like, change the culture of what goes on in my school to one, and I think key to that is to change how teachers are doing things, and to encourage them to use more digital tools within their work. So I don't want everyone to do everything in the same way. I don't want to homogenize everything with some sort of app, or, you know, Show My Homework or Firefly or Google Apps or whatever. I want people to be able to work in different ways, respond to their own needs and instincts, as it were, of how to work with their classes and the learning that they guide, and to do that. And I was wondering how difficult it would be for me to do that in an open way. So to be really honest about where it is that the school is at in public. I wondered what my head would think about that, and other people as well, because it's quite scary to people, the idea of working openly when you've got some truths to tell, and it's not necessarily the best PR, I guess.
Well, I've said this before, but I do say in this article, I think there's an implicit hubris when we, you know, I mentioned this in both posts actually, and perhaps in a bit more an obvious way in the other one, the DML Central one, when I'd use Matt Thompson's model of like a lift, which Brian has very kindly illustrated, and I think there's this assumption that, hey, if I put things out there, all of a sudden, hundreds, thousands, millions of people are going to swarm around and see what I've written, and they're going to spend their time picking it apart and looking for some kind of weakness. Whereas often the exact opposite is true. If you push stuff out there, you're going to have to fight for people to even pay attention to it, to be quite honest.
Yeah, no, I think that is the absolute truth. But what I do find is that the points that you make about when you have made the work that you're doing open and easy to find, is that when people come to visit it, they can see the history of the work and they can see it evolving, and it's very engaging for them. They can get up to speed really quickly and join in and that kind of thing, which is really good.
Yeah, and so you can bury things while they're still open, if you see what I mean. So you talked there in the earlier intro section about having like one canonical landing profile page for you. Now, mm-hmm. I've always said that you should have that for each project. So what you can do there is, if you're always sharing like one canonical link for a project, then you're in control about what things you're foregrounding and what things you're backgrounding and some things you're not even linking to from that page, if you see what I mean. So there's different times for sharing different bits of information. So let's say that really early days of the project, you're asking questions like, I've got no idea what I mean by this thing. Can anyone help me? And then 6 months later, you're further down the road, and that link, that link which is still publicly accessible, with you going, don't we know what I'm talking about? It can still be publicly accessible. You just don't put it on the front page of your website.
Yes, yes. It's that you don't put it front and center, do you?
Yeah, exactly. So things just can get progressively shinier, but if someone is determined to dig, then they can dig. And really, the only two types of people who are going to do that are either people who really love what you're doing and therefore want to find out everything about it, which will be most of them, and people who have got a proper axe to grind and want to dig to find something, some kind of dirt. And to be quite honest, if they're that motivated, they're going to find something either in the things that they're digging for, in the stuff that you're putting out there, which is open, or they'll just find anything about you anyway or make something up.
Yeah, I think, but I also think it's quite interesting, because when you're talking, I mean, so that sort of punitive attitude that people come with sometimes, sort of quite aggressive, passive-aggressive, whatever, and if they're looking to take you down, they can't really, because the whole point of working openly is that it involves other people and it's collaboration, and it's very it's not my experience that one person takes down a whole group of people in that kind of way, you know. Yeah. Undermines their work when the work is kind of open and out there for others to see, you know, the working processes can be seen and what the thoughts were and what the reactions were, etc., and the opportunities to contribute and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, and just to kind of skip between these two posts, the DML Central one, which has Brian's wonderful lift image, the four floors are zero, which is, this is like a spectrum of openness. So zero will be closed, like the default position for lots of organizations, which is if you don't belong to an organization, you can't see our stuff. Then position or lift floor number one would be not yet, and we'll return to this about how it's a killer of innovation. Two would be open. So what we've just talked about before about we're sharing URLs, public URLs, with each other. You don't have to sign in. So like on Google Docs, for example, instead of me sending and giving you access on a particular email account to this document, I just make it so it's open for editing or commentary or whatever by anyone and share that link with whoever I want to collaborate with. But then number three is shout it from the rooftops, like get people to pay attention to it, which is something which I think we forget. I think we think that open finishes at number two. Just put it out there rather than actually marketing it and pointing people towards it.
I think that's right. I think it's you do. So opening up a Google Doc for public editing, that's pretty bold. No?
Possibly, but I mean, there's ways in which you can do that, I think. So my default, if I'm working with my We Are Open colleagues, or when I was at Mozilla, or with you, Dai, mm-hmm. then I would make it so that it was editable by anybody, and I would share that big long URL that no one's ever going to be able to really guess. And I would know that if you shared that link with someone else, then there was a good reason for that. And the thing is, at the end of the day, if somebody really messed it up, then there's a revision history and we can restore it. So it's not a big deal. If I was working with somebody and I wanted to make sure that I was in control of what was in that document and nobody could, for example, let's say it was a Google spreadsheet and it involved financial thing, numbers or whatever. I didn't want someone just to change a number randomly without me noticing. Then I would give them, I'd give everybody comment level permission. Yeah. I guess comment. What I'm saying is that there's very seldom a reason, unless it's absolutely confidential, to not give people any access to it.
No, I agree. Unless you have closed information in it, then access is fine, isn't it?
Yeah. And you've got to remember, I mean, the analogy, you've just given the example of a school where there's sensitive information, etc. But you've got to remember, like Mozilla, for example, there's a paragon of openness. They're dealing with, they're known as the privacy-respecting security company, yet work extremely openly. I don't think the two things are at all mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
So just to return to the not yet bit, so I quote Matt Thompson a lot in here, and very kindly Matt's picked up on the draft that I wrote, and he took some of the ideas he'd been working on. He's writing a book at the moment around working openly, and he put his thoughts, which he put as a long comment on my draft, and he worked that up into a post of his own on his blog. He was talking about how problematic it is when people say, well, we want to work open, but we're not really ready yet. You know, we're not ready for like widespread attention. So, like, we're getting ready for that, but not yet. And what Matt says is that that's a reasonable gear to operate in, but it can become this semi-permanent holding pattern if we're not careful. Like, oh yeah, we totally want to work open, but not yet. So the idea is that you need to actually start working openly at some point if that's your plan. There's a great quote from Laura in here. So Laura put together, and there's a link to this in the blog post and the DML Central one. She, with some collaborators, put together kind of a resource called Teaching and Learning in Open Spaces.
Yeah, I was just looking at that.
Yeah, and Laura says, well, do you want to read the quote? Find it?
I will, yes. The quote says, the term openness... Is that the right one?
Some people never leave the house.
Oh, the one down. Sorry. Okay. Some people never leave their house unless they look perfect. Others go to work in shorts and sandals. The question of when to be open is kind of like, when do we want to be perfectly polished and where do we get to hang out in our pajamas?
Exactly. That's just, you know.
It is quite interesting, isn't it? I think Laura is... I mean, you put a definition of hers as well of what the term openness means in the DML post. But I think it's worth, whenever I think about openness, I think about the work that Laura's been doing with Greenpeace, which I think is really, really impressive. So we've linked to a couple of things in there. So Laura was, and I'm going to get this wrong, so I'm not going to go too in too much depth here, but was as opposed to Laura's blog on secretive to open source in our community call.
So just to give some context, the work that Laura did when she was at Mozilla in terms of corralling people together, working across different groups, she was always the go-to person. She facilitated thousands of community calls, etc. So her role at Greenpeace is to take an organization which feels like it has to be very secretive because of the activist work that it does, and to make it more open in the ways that it can be. And she's been documenting this process on her blog. So this particular one, this secretive to open source in our community call from March the 17th of this year, she talks about how the community call was an exception to the kind of culture that Greenpeace has. And it's a slow process. You know, she, when I talk to her, she's, you know, this is still a, like, softly, you know, approach to kind of doing change. But the idea is that you're changing mindsets here, and you have to kind of model the behaviors that you want to see in the world. So this open call where people get to build up but also criticize, to share resources and break down silos, that modeling of behaviors allows people to see what openness looks like in action. Because if it's just a form of words, if it's like, hey, we want to work more openly, then it's difficult to be able to agree or disagree with that. And given that people love the status quo and kind of shun change so much, it's a difficult thing to agree with unless you can see what it actually is in practice.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And Laura has sort of forged this way of, and through community calls, through getting different people from different communities surrounded by Greenpeace, surrounding Greenpeace, involved. She's slowly opened this up, and it's all moved forward into something called Planet 4. Mm. And without wanting to go into too much detail, I've just put a link into the Planet 4 channel on Medium, so that people can go and have a look at the... So if you click on that link, it has a chronological set of posts. The first four are by Laura as she's sort of opening it up and getting people in, and you can see other people are contributing.
Planet 4, basically there's going to be a new Greenpeace.org website. And this kind of thing, I think historically in lots of organizations, including Greenpeace, this would be the kind of thing that happens behind closed doors with senior management and a design agency, etc. And in, almost in the same way that Mozilla is redoing its logo design in the open, this is doing the different phases of planning a new website, like the discovery phase and getting some participation, doing the UX design, etc. This is blogging all this out. And you mentioned that before, Di. The fact that you wrote a blog post after MozFest means that way more people, including the people listening to this podcast, can find out about your experiences, dip a toe into the water, follow some links, have their appetites whetted, etc. And if you blog, I think blogging is almost like a core thing of working openly, because what you're doing is you're letting people know about stuff, but you're also synthesizing things and providing insights in a way that will be very difficult to grok. If you just presented people with, like, here's 100 documents, it'd be very difficult to understand what was going on if you did that. So kind of just publishing lots of stuff isn't enough. You have to synthesize it, and that's what Planet 4 is doing, I guess.
Yes, it's bringing it all together. The discussion is the place where the new Greenpeace.org is being built, essentially.
Yeah,
it's awesome. Anyway, I'm really, really impressive of, like, a big organization going through a process of moving into an open world, what an open way of working, and I think it's really good.
Yeah. Just while we're talking about openness, I think I want to run some workshops on working openly. I had to postpone the ones I was going to run in December at London Connected Learning Centre. I was going to do a one on badges and digital literacies in the morning, and a one on working open with my cooperative colleagues in the afternoon, because there's going to be train strikes, RMT train strikes with Southern Trains because they're so rubbish. So I'm going to rearrange for maybe January, February. But the kind of things I want to cover in that workshop are both mindsets and skill sets, because I feel like people think it's one or the other, but actually the synthesis of the two is really important. And if you're leading any kind of this is a change management process, and if you're leading a change management process, you mentioned you're not too sure what your head would say, etc. Like, it has to have buy-in from the top, like any change management process. But you also have to have some kind of resource allocation, significant resource allocation. That might be money, it might be someone's time. It could be kit, investment in kit. It could be branding, whatever it's going to be. But I feel like working open is a change management process, and it follows some of those common ways of doing change management. So the idea of thinking that you could do working open just by doing grassroots activism within your organization, that's going to get stamped out pretty quickly, I would say. And the opposite is true as well. If you think that you can get people to work open by mandating it from the top, that's not going to work either.
No, it has to be a process, doesn't it? Mm. That's the thing. You're talking about skill sets. I would say the mindset's the most important thing. Skill sets come with the mindsets, kind of. You know, if you're changing mindsets, then the skill sets are going to come. And I think they're... to say that their domino effect is paying them a disservice, I think, but you do have to address them directly. But if you're getting people to change the way change their minds about how they do things, then they will change their skill set to match.
No, I agree. I think you can convince people, but I think the opposite can be true as well. Like, you can show people a different way of doing things, and then they didn't realize that you could do that thing, and it changes their view
Absolutely
of the
true.
Digital universe.
I mean, that's sort of what I'm doing with so I have a digital learning party Google Plus community, which 24 people in my school have signed up for, and I'm just sort of trying to introduce different ways of doing things to them, and different ideas, kind of thing, and
just
see what
to, just to quickly run through in this Nasterian post, and the one that's entitled "The Unexpected Benefits of Working Open," just put some steps in here about how to work more open. Just a note on this, actually. Everyone has their own editorial decisions, and they're paying me to provide the content, and they can, I guess, do what they like with it. But they've written it. I put this in proper paragraphs, and they've separated out per sentence almost, like it's in the Daily Mirror. But hey, I'm not being critical. That's just the way that it is. But it makes it difficult for me to find my own stuff. So. Some of the next steps about how to work more open, if you're listening to this and you think, yes, I want to work more open and I do have senior management buy-in and I do have resource allocation, and these are the things that I would do. First of all, I'd make everything easy to find. And there was some kind of research done when I was researching this stuff, which said it's something like knowledge workers spend 40% of their time looking for information within an organization. Like, it's not just at their fingertips. And one of the advantages, which has financial implications, is if you make things open and you put things in a place that people can find, then they're not wasting huge amounts of their time trying to find that stuff. So that would be number one, make things easy to find. Second thing is embrace a diversity of ways of working. So what this means is not just forcing people to work within a monoculture and a particular way of working, a particular communication style or a particular channel or whatever, but making it so that you're documenting or making people aware of the different ways in which people can communicate, and being aware of how certain people within a project prefer to communicate, and making sure that that's kind of accommodated, not forcing people to do things in a certain way. And then third, documenting everything. So we've mentioned blogging, and as I say in the post, a negative way of that this happens already within organizations is the kind of person, and I'm sure you've come across this before, Di, the kind of person who has a conversation with you and then will email you straight after getting back to their desk and document that conversation in a way which paints them in an amazing light and you in not such a good light, and actually gives you loads of work to do. So that's not what I mean. When I say document all the things, I mean blogging openly. I mean working, for example, on GitHub, where you can see the changes in the pull request, or Google Docs, where you can see the revision history. So just documenting everything so that people can see what you're doing, and people can call bullshit if you're actually changing the narrative and changing the story. So I think that's a useful thing to do. And yeah, at the end of that post, I say it's actually quite difficult to put into words the difference between working in traditional closed ways and working in more progressive, open and transparent way. You kind of have to just experience it, which is why I really respect, as you said, what Laura's doing, because she's giving people the opportunity to taste the difference rather than just, you know, banging a fist on the table saying we should work more open. She's showing how it's a more valuable thing to do. So yeah.
Cool. Excellent. I think your post, your NASTAR post particularly, is excellent. And I think they're just sort of simple steps and just a way of thinking about how you make a change happen.
Thank you.
It's good. Right.
Moving on. I have put another post in here called, well, it's not a post, it's actually a journal article. So there's, again, a wonderful example of an open peer-reviewed journal, academic journal on the internet called First Monday. I think it was the first ever open peer review journal on the internet. Mm-hmm. And this is called 50 Shades of Open. I think we've actually mentioned it before, came out earlier this year.
Yes.
And it goes through what open means in different situations, because open is one of those words which is sometimes unhelpfully ambiguous, because people can do open washing in the same way that people do green washing, you know, pretend to be all environmentally friendly, but they're not really. People can pretend to be, like Pearson do this a lot, pretend to be open as in like, hey, we love open educational resources, when actually what they mean is open for business. But I don't think we should go through this in detail, but it's just worth pointing to in terms of when you hear someone say open and you've never really heard them use it in that particular way before, like open meaning participatory, then look through this because it's actually really well written and researched.
Yeah, and it's good. So in the conclusion it says, and as the word open is used more, it will inevitably be used in new and sometimes confusing ways. Ambiguity leads to misinterpretation, and this essay is an attempt to disambiguate the many meanings of the word open. Hopefully this essay has clarified the current state of affairs with regard to the use of this word.
Yep.
Which is good. So if you are thinking about working openly and wanting to do that, this article is a bit of a must read, I think, just to help center your thoughts about it and how you talk to others about it.
I think so. I would say that there's useful ways in which things can be ambiguous, but that would be to get off the point. Right. Good. So anything else to discuss on working openly? Probably something we'll come back to time and time again.
I think it's one of those things, isn't it? I certainly think there's a place for working openly in the work that I'm doing. So I'm going to have a good think about it and try and come up with a means of incorporating it more into my work.
Awesome. Good. Well, let's move on then. Did you see this week? So we recorded on the same day last week, I think, that Microsoft released their Surface Studio, and we talked about that video which channeled Creepy Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
And then the next day, Apple had their event where they announced the new MacBook Pro.
They did. The thinner, lighter. It's almost non-existent. There is going to be a MacBook Pro, I think, that doesn't actually... You spend like £2,000 and get nothing. You know what I mean? It's just like disappeared, or just like a sheet of metal.
Well,
anyway.
I did see something quite funny. So for those who haven't seen this yet... the new MacBook Pro, as Di said, is thinner and lighter and more wonderful and sleeker, but it's also got a new edition and also some things that have been removed. So the things that have been removed are a lot of the ports and lots of the inputs, so things like SD card slots and even, I mean, this is ridiculous as far as I can see, the best thing about a MacBook Pro, the MagSafe adapter, so that if you stumble over the power lead, it doesn't pull your MacBook off the table. The MagSafe magnetic power thing just comes out. They've removed that as well.
Well, I think that is such a good piece of design and technology, or design in technology, the actual magnetic connector for your power, that they must have taken it because it can't deliver fast enough recharging, I think. I don't see why they've done it, and it's a bit annoying that it's not been explained anywhere that I've seen anyway.
Mm.
I haven't read much about it, to be honest. But they've also they stripped away other really sort of standard ports. So taking away an HDMI port is boring. Taking away the SD card slot is very boring, particularly if you're a photographer and you're moving digital media around very quickly. So transferring over wires is always going to be much slower than transferring in other ways, by sticking a card into your machine directly. It's kind of a bit annoying. But you have to say, though, you know, Apple have done, I mean, they've obviously removed the headphone, the 3.5mm headphone jack from the iPhone. And therefore, you have to buy either Bluetooth headphones or ones that work with, is it the C thing?
Yeah, but I mean, this is the kind of
but they have a good
less politically correct version of me would say the schizophrenic approach to hardware design. So they've still got the hardware port in the MacBook Pro, so the headphone jack, but you can't actually plug an iPhone into it because an iPhone is normal USB and not USB-C, so you need an adapter to plug your iPhone into your MacBook Pro, and there's not an escape button, and so the touch bar is the thing that they've added. And I thought the whole thing, I'll not read the whole blog post out, but someone put in the Slack channel a blog post on the Pinboard blog, which is obviously the guy who writes that is a genius. And he there's been a bit of an outcry in the developer community. So people who are programmers, people who are designers, etc. And apparently there's about 90 million of those worldwide. And there's about 90 million MacBook Pros being sold, which I think is just coincidental. But I think the point is that developers feel like this is their device and that Apple's done something very wrong. So what this guy on the Pinboard blog has, the approach he's taken is, imagine Benjamin Button, you know, famously the guy who was born old and gets younger. Imagine that this is happening backwards. And they say things like, the new MacBook Pro shows that Apple is finally becoming serious about developers. Gone is the gimmicky touch bar, gone are the four USB ports, USB-C ports that force power users to carry a suitcase full of dongles. In their place, we get a cornucopia of developer-friendly ports, two USB 3 and Thunderbolt 2 ports, a redesigned power connector, and a long-awaited HDMI port. So basically, by running this backwards, it shows how Apple's basically removed and added all the things that developers would want or need. You know what I mean? Like, they've been a bit tone-deaf. And a lot of people are... There's loads of posts. I mean, on Hacker News, on Medium, people I follow... saying that now's the time they're going to start using Linux, looking at different laptops. People really, really put out about this kind of move, especially in the wake of Microsoft seeming to get their stuff together in terms of the Surface Studio.
I think that's right. I just clicked on a sidebar article which says why the touch bar was the right move. And they're saying because touchscreen laptops aren't the same as tablets, and this sort of is a compromise between that. And I think that's quite an interesting thing. I don't think the touch bar is necessarily a bad thing. I just think like losing the escape key and your function keys is a bad thing, you know. But I guess the touch bar will become programmable and whatever.
If you go down the bottom of that TechCrunch article, it says, recommended for you, Apple says no fun allowed on the touch bar. And what it says in there is, if you watch the video, it shows emojis popping up, etc. And the guidance they've given to developers is that the touch bar should be an extension of the keyboard. So, yes, you can scroll backwards and forwards, like in iMovie and things. You can add emojis, that kind of stuff. But the idea is that it's not supposed to be a screen replacement. So you can't do things that people would expect on the screen. Now, the annoying thing, if you're actually like a touch typist, etc., is that you don't get any tactile feedback from the touch bar, which means that, yes, you can use the touch bar as a button, like you can get the escape key in the touch bar, but you're not getting any tactile feedback, so it makes it very difficult to touch type or use it without looking down at the keyboard. So for me, it's a step backwards.
I think it's I think you have to use it and see it in anger. I don't really give a hoot. I think it's very disappointing that this is what happens whenever Apple do something innovative which goes against the grain, is that people actually don't see the sensibility on it in the beginning, and everyone complains about it, and then like when they've got rid of things like CD drives or whatever, this has been the case. And And then people slowly adapt to it and get used to it because they kind of have to. But I think there's something a bit sort of worse going on here, which is that you need to... Is it a MacBook Pro if you bought now a well-specced MacBook Pro before this? You don't need to buy another machine for years. Do you know what I mean? And they're really good quality pieces of kit, et cetera, et cetera. And they'll last a long time because they're running on SSD. It's not hard disk drives anymore. And all that kind of thing. They just work faster for longer. And therefore, the need to actually purchase a new one disappears. So kind of Apple have to reinvent the reason to buy a new computer. And this
is going back to that example you gave there. So Apple famously never put a Blu-ray, Blu-ray drive in any Apple product. And yeah. I can remember, if you search YouTube for like Steve Jobs Blu-ray or whatever, there's a wonderful Q&A session where someone who's pretty annoyed says, like, where's the innovation? Like, what's going on? Why is there no Blu-ray in Apple products? And Steve Jobs gives this really considered answer saying, look, here's the thing. This is what we do. Here's my reasoning. Here's why we're doing it. Where... there's none of that in the kind of new version of Apple. And I don't really give a flying toss, to be quite honest, like you. So I'm using a 2011 Mac Mini server, and I use this on as kind of desktop machine. But the rest of the time, I use a Chromebook Pixel, which does have a very shiny and also touch-sensitive screen, which I use when I'm, you know, scrolling through articles sometimes zooming on Google Maps and whatever. And yeah, it gets smudgy and whatever. But so did the screen of my MacBook Pro, which my wife's now got. That really got smudgy because things get smudgy anyway over time, because you end up touching them to open and close the screen or to wipe a bit of dust off or whatever. So I think this is, and I don't really care either way, it feels like Apple grabbing for something which locks people into a proprietary ecosystem and adds a point of differentiation, and there's actually no reason to do it, and
Well, I think that's the other thing, is that if you don't really know, when you see one MacBook Pro alongside another, you don't really know which version it is until you actually look at it in detail. Mm-hmm. And by doing the changes that they're doing, they're actually changing, it's making it very obvious that someone's got the latest new shiny or not. And
That's what they do with iPhones, don't they? They make it kind of squarish and then roundish and then squarish again.
Yeah, exactly. And just so people can see. But the truth of it is, I think, most of the consumers I know don't give a hoot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? If their phone is doing what they need it to do, they don't care about getting a new phone, and that kind of thing. It's only when it starts underperforming that it's an issue. Mm-hmm. And as I say, as tech gets better, they are going to perform well, these devices.
So from the stuff I've read, if you're thinking about not getting a MacBook Pro as a result of this and you're in the market for a new laptop, then it looks like the Dell XPS 13 is the one to get, because it's fast, open, extensible, all that kind of stuff. You can get it with Windows, but you also get one directly from Dell, which has Ubuntu Linux LTS, long-term support version, built in. So you might want to try that instead. And I have to say, if you tried Linux 10 years ago and you thought, oh my goodness, if you try something like Elementary OS that I've mentioned before, and some of the operating systems that are the distributions that I've mentioned on recent podcasts, given that a lot of us spend a lot of the time on the web, you wouldn't really know much difference.
Ain't that the truth? Right. Tell me about this article you put in, Government Scraps for Education for All Bill. I've not heard about it.
So Justine Greening is now the schools minister, isn't she? She's the education minister. And she has announced that the decision to axe the bill for all... this is in the Times Educational Supplement. The decision to axe the Education for All bill was slipped into a written ministerial statement published by Education Secretary Justine Greening this afternoon. So this was last week. The move means government plans to force schools in England in underperforming or unviable local authorities to convert to academy status have been shelved indefinitely. So the idea was that the government would wield a big stick and would, by hook or by crook, they employed people to find ways to do this, basically, around the country. they would find ways to force schools into academy status. And this is an admission of defeat, really, and said that we'll find other ways of doing this. And this is great, because it means that local authorities have stood up, schools have said no, and the government is backing off a bit. So, happy days.
It is. Would you say it's fair to say that making a school an academy is just a way of privatising that school?
It's not directly privatising it, so, I mean, people listening to this might be able to correct me, but the difference between getting your money... It's all to do with finance and decision-making, really, and the two are inextricably linked. So in a local authority school, which all schools were until academies came along, the money would be given to the local authority, and then the local authority would give it to the school, and either the local authority would decide by themselves, depending on how strong they were, or schools would allow them to voluntarily give, allow money to be kind of creamed off or siphoned off to do kind of collective bargaining powers to provide things across local areas. Yeah. And I think that the idea of the Conservative government, who kind of took the Labour government academy programme and made it into something entirely different, was that this would be a way of doing some kind of privatisation. And the way that that would happen would be through the academy programme and the formation of multi-academy trusts, or MATs for short. So multi-academy trusts can often be geographically located, so schools in a local area, but they don't have to be. They might be thematic, they might specialise in types of schools, so ones which are in extremely deprived areas, they might, you know, specialise in getting them out of dire circumstances. But those multi-academy trusts, they would get money as a trust directly from the government, and at the moment they have to be kind of non-profit. They're not allowed to make a profit. But everything was really being set up on some kind of roadmap, as far as I could see, for the money goes to multi-academy trusts, and then that money goes to schools. And then there's no reason in the future for these multi-academy trusts, I think Michael Gove didn't rule it out or something, multi-academy trusts to then be able to make a profit in the future, which would, at a stroke, then privatise the entire school system.
Mm-hmm. It's also worth saying that the people working for these academy trusts are paid extraordinary amounts.
So even when back in 2009, when I was working in an academy, and the executive head there was on like 150 grand, and then there was other incentives and stuff, and some of them are on after, you know, some of them have set up companies. I mean, we're not talking about all of them. We were talking about some who've managed to abuse the system. Some kind of executive heads have managed to set up companies, and they employ those companies to do some of the work in the schools, and they're, you know, they're taking home £500,000 every year.
Mm. Well, it's good news that it's not being forced through, I guess.
Yes, I think it's good.
This is a good thing.
Happy days. Other things in here. Oh, we talked about some of this last week, about kind of distributed denial of service attacks based on Internet of Things devices like baby monitors and CCTV cameras. And this particular one in The Atlantic is talking about the inevitability of being hacked. We built a fake web toaster and it was compromised in an hour.
Within an hour? Yeah. Fantastic. 39 minutes ago. Oh, okay. That's quite funny. They've got live data on this web page.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So the next hacking attempt from a different IP address and using different login credentials came at 2:07 p.m., the next at 2:10, the next 2:40, 2:48. In all, more than 300 different IP addresses attempted to hack my honeypot by 11:59, many of them using the password XC3511, which was the factory default for many of the old webcams hijacked in last week's attack. Wow. That's interesting, isn't it?
Some of the stuff, a lot of this is automated, so hence the password thing. But yeah, later on, the guy says, quote, "It's now within the capability of hackers to literally scan the entire internet looking for vulnerable servers with open ports. And every hacked computer adds another recruit to the search effort, shortening the time required geometrically." So, like, exponential hacking of the internet, basically.
It is that. Oddly, my little brother, who's a software engineer, programmer, has his own business, His Skype account was hacked today, and I foolishly clicked on the link, which I don't think had any effect on my Skype account, but he had a message sent to all 200 of his contacts on Skype. He's an international worker, so he uses Skype all the time. Which was
I have to say, so when you messaged me saying, hey, I'm not sure if I've been hacked, you know, if you get a link, then don't click it from me. I don't log into Skype apart from really this particular call. I use other services. So we record this podcast through Skype. But when I went in, then I've got links from, I'm not going to mention who they are. This time I've logged in three of my contacts. So it's a similar kind of link. It's Baidu, B-A-I-D-U, which is a Russian site, isn't it?
That's the one.
And it looks, it's got a big long URL, and it says Doug Belshaw at the end. Now, for me, who knows how URLs are formed, like I can tell that Doug Belshaw thing plays no part in the content of the link, so it makes no difference, and there's no way I'm going to click on that. And
well, that was the funny thing when I did click on it, because it was from my little brother, and he would send me links every now and then about stuff. Mm-hmm. I did click on it, and then I saw, as I clicked on it, I was looking at the URL rather than looking at it before I clicked, and I saw exactly that dive bar on the end of the link, and mm-hmm. I was just, oh dear, where am I?
But yeah, I mean, like yourself, these are people who, you know, when you're thinking about this, you think, well, that's just dodgy. But when you're doing things in just like the pace of life, etc., these are people who usually know not to click on these links. And I'm not being smug at all, because I've certainly in the past clicked on things and had to rectify, you know, stuff.
Oh, so. Done that.
So there we are.
Right. The last link in here is a link to a YouTube movie called Hypernormalization. Now, I raved on about a film called Bitter Lake by Adam Curtis about a year ago or something like that. Really, really fantastic film on the history of politics since the Second World War, centered around Afghanistan, but not about Afghanistan exclusively by any means, about the Western world as well. Really, really fascinating two-hour film. It's a long watch. He's done another one. It's called Hypernormalization. And it's on the iPlayer, but I put this link in because it's actually on YouTube, so people can watch this anywhere, I guess. But it's 2 hours and 40 minutes long. It has lots of really, it's really up to date, and it's really interesting about the idea of normalizing content for people and the effect that that's having on the world, and etc. But the most interesting thing about this to me was that he talks about post-truth politics. So the most insightful thing that I saw was that in Russia, the guy who runs Putin's PR for him uses this method by which he actually invests money in anti-government social groups so that they rise up in society, and they organize events and do whatever, protests and things. And he does this, and then he takes the money away, and they just disappear. And you get this sort of jumping around going on, and quite a large, very high profile, very media covered scale. And then they disappear again. And what happens is that nobody really knows what protests are going on because they're not consistent. And so he basically fuels all of these things so that nobody actually can tell what real government is, what the truth is, and what the truth isn't. And then this is aligned by Adam Curtis to Donald Trump's campaign in America to become president, which I'm not into Donald Trump bashing. I really don't like that, because I worry that all the bashing kind of hides the truth from people who will potentially vote for Trump, which would be a dreadful thing if that happened. I think it serves to actually get him into power potentially more than it does to ridicule and mock him.
Well, such a big thing as bad publicity, eh?
Well, exactly. But this is the thing. So there's a little clip in the film where Putin talks about Donald Trump, and he says twice, very carefully, it is not our job to interpret the internal workings of what Donald Trump says. So he basically makes no comment on anything that Donald Trump says. He just said he's a very clever and very talented man. that's what he thinks about him. And it's because so Donald Trump is effectively fueling these things. That's why he doesn't care what he says, or seemingly doesn't care. And he says things that are conflicting and, you know, don't agree with each other, because he's not actually trying to tell the truth. He's trying to cloud the media with lies. And then he just goes and says, well, it's all lies that people are telling about me. This is the core thing. This is that. This is the other. And that's why people actually vote for him, because you can't be anything but confused by everything that is presented to you, and therefore it's like, you know, you can't see the wood for the trees, and you just listen to the one tree and it tells you what's going on, kind of thing. It's a very clever technique. And there's a sort of another post is in The Economist, a sort of backup post, which is entitled The Art of the Lie. And how politicians have always lied, but does it matter that if they leave the truth behind entirely? And it discusses that in light of this post, and it's a really interesting post about post-truth politics. Which,
well, to me, this is, you know, so you've watched the whole thing, all 2 hours 40 minutes.
I have.
Wow, half term.
Half term, yeah.
I don't know if I'll get a chance to do that, but I might watch it in bits. To me, this is totally an education. It's a media literacy issue, isn't it? Like, the only way in which we can deal in, and I hate the term kind of post-truth society, because it suggests that there was an objective truth to begin with, but the only way in which we can deal with that is by having the tools in which to decode the media, and also to remix it, and to know what's going on, and to discuss it in forms which are horizontal and aren't controlled and mediated by the very people who are trying to manipulate stuff. It's very kind of 1984 in that sense. So I wish I could set aside time to watch all this. I probably should.
Well, I think, I mean, it's packed full of really interesting bits, but its length doesn't help you much. Do you know what I mean? It is really, really long, and there's a lot to take in.
Certainly, it's a perfect example, looking on YouTube, of why you should never read the comments. Anyway. Good, good. Yeah. Anything else? Oh, you put that Economist article in, Art of a Lie. Thank you very much. Right, yeah, what are you up to this week then, Mr. Barnes?
This week I am teaching. We did this lovely little lesson the other day. So input and output devices is a tricky thing to teach because it's so boring and dry. And so I sent my lower six out with their phones to take pictures of all the input and output devices they could find around Andel Town in all the shops and on the streets and whatever. So that was quite fun.
Input output devices, you mean, for example...
keyboards and mice and monitors and printers and LED units, LCD units, whatever's used. So really different things. And the opticians, for example, of how you get people's biological information into a computer, and to ATMs, and how all ATMs are exactly the same because they're built by the same company, even though they're provided by different banks, and that kind of thing. And then also the really interesting thing to me is looking at different organizations, different shops. You have a lot of independent shops as well as high street chain shops in Andel. And so, you know, you're going from Tesco's to the cobbler's kind of thing, and seeing the different choices that they've made and the kit that they're using. So the different devices that they've chosen. So it seems like you're going to get mouse and keyboards, but you're not. There's loads of different electronic points of sale. Those have got chip and pin. Those have got contactless. Those have got, bespoke touchscreens for bars and cafes and things like that. And looking at that different thing. So just trying to sort of spruce up the content with a little bit of real-world application, really. So tomorrow I've got a Slack lesson with that class, so I'll be doing that online, so I have to stay in for a BT engineer to come around for the third time to install my landline. I'm kind of touching wood that it's going to be achieved tomorrow morning.
Well, we were talking about this just before we started, before we hit record, and you said that you look forward to these kind of Slack lessons, these ones where when you're not in the same room together, but you're kind of working together on things, because it's helping prepare them for a world of remote work and not necessarily being in an office and being in the same time zone and things.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. So in a classroom setup, the pupils are very accustomed to being held accountable for whatever it is they're doing in that time. But if you do it on an online way, they kind of have... just hurdles that they need to jump over, you know, of how, you know, what they're doing, how they're spending their time. It's not on video, it's just on text. I have to manipulate the lesson so that I can see that they've actually been doing something and doing the work that we're doing, and then some follow-up work. And how you hold each other accountable for just not sitting there polishing your shoes kind of thing, but actually something.
There's a book which I haven't read yet, but it was on Hacker News today. So Zapier, which is a bit like IFTTT, you can connect things together and stuff, and I think a lot of their team work remotely. There's a book they put together called The Ultimate Guide to Remote Work, and I think if you, it's free, you kind of subscribe to their blog by email and then you get the free ebook download. It might be a nice thing to discuss in terms of...
So this is class's first time. I've done this with other classes before, but this class's first time in the Slack channel doing what we're doing. So it might be worth doing it. Ultimate Guide to Remote Working, you say?
Because, I mean, if you're doing it in a blended way, then there's going to be elements of this which are relevant. But I would say that having... You know, as you know, I worked for 3 years from Zilla remotely. It's a definite mindset and skill set shift, and I'd love to actually write some more about that at some point, and yeah, actually work remotely entirely again, because it's an interesting approach. Anyway, I'm going to be working with my We Are Open colleagues, or Brian in particular, on Friday. I'm going to be doing a think-a-thon for Sunderland Council, who are thinking about joining together their learning organisations in ways which may or may not involve badges. So we're thinking about that. And then next week, I am going to be in Jersey doing some work there. And on the Tuesday, just before we record this, so I'll be able to reflect on it, it's Venture Fest. So Venture Fest is an event I haven't been to before. It originated in Oxford, so maybe Elon Ezekiel's been to it before. And it's the Northeast one. There's going to be about 700 people there at St. James's Park in Newcastle. So it's about bringing people together who are entrepreneurial, people who are investing, all different kinds of things to think about how... It's being organized by this innovation super network. So after meeting one of the organizers and she convinced me to go along, I'm going to go along and see what it's all about.
Fantastic. Sounds good. Right. Well, that's been great. It's great to see you on Saturday.
Yes, likewise.
And we'll speak next week. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Until then, thank you very much for listening, everybody. And this has been Tide Episode 67, Working Open.
Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of a bay, wasting time.